Coming up, it's the World Cafe. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. Telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find playlists, podcasts, and more at KAXE.org.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds' 2024 album, Wild God, is a joyous record. It's a contrast to Cave's previous two albums, which saw him grappling with the death of his son. And it's not that the grief went away on Wild God. Instead, it's as if Nick has metabolized it, incorporated it into his worldview, his art, and his soul.
It really took the devastation to understand and accept the possibility of a kind of joyful relationship with the world.
Last week, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds released Live God, a live album documenting their Wild God tour. So we're revisiting last year's session with Nick. He talks about his live performances as well, including how he keeps his balance when he steps into the crowd at his concerts.
It's actually rather easy to walk on people's heads. You should try it.
Nick Cave, today. I'm Raina Duras. This is an Encore World Cafe.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. As artificial intelligence becomes more ubiquitous with modern-day life, the demand for data centers is growing, and developers are increasingly looking away from urban places to build them. Rural America offers plenty of space to develop renewable energy sources in sprawling campuses, and rural communities usually have more relaxed regulatory processes for construction compared to dense urban centers. In the land of 10,000 lakes, data center developers may be attracted to tax breaks offered by the Minnesota legislature in 2025, in addition to the state's cold climate. While about 80 data centers are concentrated around the Twin Cities, more are being built in suburban and rural areas. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is slated to open a data center in Rosemount in 2026. 12 more hyperscale data centers are in various phases of exploration in the state, including a Hermantown project that has been on hold since mid-November. These projects bring promises of construction jobs, technician jobs, and a boost to local property tax revenue, but some environmental and grassroots groups are concerned about how data centers can negatively impact rural communities.
There's a lot of capacity, technical capacity and expertise that comes with being in the metro area that rural Minnesota and rural municipalities and communities just don't have. There's not a consistency of access to engineers and hydrologists and all of that's entailed to manage these complex projects.
That was Peg Fershong from CURE, a rural environmental advocacy group that focuses on issues in greater Minnesota during the November meeting of the Environmental Quality Board. During this meeting, the EQB hosted its second informational session on data centers with a focus on water resources. Data centers are essentially warehouses that host servers that power the internet, from mobile phone applications to sensitive government data systems. The servers are seldom powered off due to the 24/7, 365 demands of internet users, requiring more systems to cool them down. That's where data centers can call for large volumes of water. In the data center regulations cleared by the legislature at the end of last session, the State Department of Natural Resources can inquire about water resources as developers plan out data centers. From the DNR, Assistant Ecological and Water Resources Director Jason Meckel explains to EQB board members.
What's the geology? Therefore, what do we know about the availability of water? What are the existing users in the area? What kind of natural resources are associated with those aquifers? And given an understanding of what's proposed for how the water will be used, when it will be used, how it will be pumped, what might the constraints be at that given site?
The DNR issues water appropriations permits when projects are expected to use at least 100 million gallons per year. While Minnesota is a very wet state, there are frequent periods of drought, and aquifers can draw down in the summer with agriculture's irrigation demands. Steve Robertson from the Minnesota Department of Health says cities with municipal water systems have much to consider when approving data center developments.
There's the general issue of maintaining the public trust. So with a public water system, that's a key consideration. It's largely because new large developments of all kinds, including those involving new large volume water users, really bear on maintaining or stewarding the public trust relative to delivering a product like drinking water that many people prioritize for their own public health protection.
If the data center plans include establishing a new water supply, that can affect private well owners as well, Robertson says.
It would not be unusual for a new large volume water user to satisfy its needs by developing a new source of supply. In Minnesota, that's most commonly going to be with a new well. And the principal issue that this presents to the local community is that a new well has the potential to alter the groundwater flow regime in a significant way.
If a new large well is established, nearby smaller wells with shorter straws may have difficulty accessing the water from the same aquifer. Information from these data center sessions in October and November is slated to help guide further work for the Environmental Quality Board focused on its two priorities, supporting program development on emerging environmental issues and to improve the state's environmental review program. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is an Encore World Cafe. I'm Raina Duras. Last week, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds released a new live album called Live God. It documents their recent Wild God tour. So today, listening back to my 2024 session with Nick Cave, where we discuss his album, Wild God. Enjoy. Nick Cave's songwriting has always had a preoccupation with death. From the violence in the music he made in his early Melbourne days with his band The Birthday Party, to his grisly murder ballads that made him a breakout star stateside in the mid-90s. More recently, death appeared in a literal and more personal way on the mournful, haunted albums Skeleton Tree and Ghosteen, as Cave grappled with the grief of losing not one, but two of his sons. But throughout his work, there's also always been a thread of light, of salvation. A Nick Cave show can feel like a sermon, complete with gospel singers and the audience playing the part of worshipers in a way, hands outstretched, looking to be blessed by this tall, wiry figure in his sharp black suit. On his new album with the Bad Seeds called Wild God, it's that light that finally shines through. On Wild God, the death is still present, but instead of grief shrouding the world with darkness, it illuminates life. Nick Cave joins me to talk about making Wild God, about life and death, about religion, about fear and joy, and about frogs. Our conversation in just a moment, but first, some of the title track from Wild God. This is Nick Cave on World Cafe.
She would hang under the rail as he blew around the room and make love with a kind of efficient glue. And the people on the ground cried, oh, when does it start? And the wild God says it starts with the heart, with the heart, with the heart, with the heart. And the people on the ground cried, oh, when does it end? And the wild God says, well, it depends, but it mostly never ends. 'Cause I'm a wild God flying in a swimming, and I'm an old sick god dying and crying and singing. Yeah.
That's some of the title track to Wild God, the new album from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I'm Raina Duras on World Cafe. Nick Cave is my guest today. First of all, Nick, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You began writing Wild God on New Year's Day of 2023, which seems like an auspicious day to begin writing a new album. Why did you choose that day?
Well, it begins before that. My manager comes to me and says, I think it's time for you to make a new record. These are the last words I ever want to hear anyone say to me, because it kicks off a whole sequence of events, some of which are deeply unpleasant. And one of those is to actually write the lyrics for a new record. And so the way I do it is I set a date and then just go to work. I haven't thought about a record for 2 or 3 years. I haven't thought about any lyrics. I don't have groovy titles written down in a notebook or anything. I just hate songwriting. I hate lyric writing is the problem. And I go about trying to create some songs on my own, sitting there, getting up at 9 o'clock in the morning and finishing about 5:30. This takes a few months. And it's a sort of weirdly dark, self-reflective, anxiety-ridden time. And I'm not that pleasant to be around. And, my wife suffers through this every few years. And eventually I have enough lyrics and I ring up Warren, who I write music with, Warren Ellis these days, and say, look, I've got some words, let's go into the studio. And once I enter the studio and once I'm with my musicians and with the Bad Seeds, that whole thing changes into something that's just pure pleasure.
Yeah. Way. And so it emerges as you're working
with them. And the very beautiful thing is that if you've got a great band, they make the things that you write sound extraordinary. The music kind of for me sort of fills the words with meaning, and sometimes the music's so beautiful that these guys make that I can kind of sing anything over the top of it, and it's just, it sounds important, you know.
The way that this record starts, the first time I listened to it, I had just repeat listen to Ghosteen again, just to kind of get situated.
Once there was a song yearned to be sung. It was a spinning song about the king of rock and roll.
The Song of the Lake begins, and it's this burst of light. It feels like a joyful record right away. There's a choir behind you. There's this very, it's a very different feeling.
Yeah, that's right.
Could you talk about starting the record that way?
On the shore of the lake, the old man sat and watched a woman bathing. With his golden touch, the light was such that the moment was worth saving. And he sang the song of the lake.
Well, someone who had a huge impact on the record was a guy called Dave Friedman. Mm. And we sort of brought him late into the whole thing because we'd recorded the record. We don't really use producers anymore. The sort of mixes to me, the rough mixes that we did sounded, they just sort of sounded like old Bad Seed stuff. There was something that that was overly familiar. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but they just like I'd heard some of this stuff before. And so we decided to kind of find someone that could mix it and take it away from us and add their own something into it. I've always loved the Flaming Lips sound and the MGMT stuff a lot, as extraordinary sounding kind of pop music in a way. So we went and saw him, and he literally, me and Warren took the tapes to Buffalo, where he lives, and in this little studio in the woods with no staff in it, it's just him and his kids. And he takes the songs away from you and goes into a room on his own and doesn't invite you into the process, which was quite shocking for me and Warren, to have our baby taken off us. And he mixes it as he feels it should sound. And so the first, so he mixes one song and emerges out of the studio at about between 3 and 4, having mixed a song, the song for the day. And the first one we went in, and it just sounded so different, so weird, and so so beyond our, what we imagined it to be. We were really shocked by it, you know. We were confused by it, and then we listened to it again, and we listened to it a third time. By the third time, we were just like, wow, this is really beautiful. This is taking all the nuance and the kind of the sort of musicality and elegance of the Bad Seeds, and just crushing the whole lot into a sort of sound that's just pure emotion, just sort of leaps out at you, and it speaks clearly about its intention, you know. As you say, it just leaps out of the speaker, and we really love this. So he had a huge impact on the emotional sound of the record.
Yeah. I mean, the emotional sound of the record is quite different from the last few records. And I know that Skeleton Tree, I guess starting with Push the Sky Away, Skeleton Tree, and then Ghosteen were sort of considered kind of a trilogy. And I'm not sure when that emerged for you, because I know lots happened in that time. Is Wild God the beginning of something in your mind?
No, people kept saying that, or they kept, you know, with each one, they seemed to be of a part of a unfolding sort of narrative about the sort of personal things that were going on in my life. And I think this one just carries on the story in some degree. It's... To me, this record feels sort of, there's a sort of earned pleasure to it, or joy to it. It's not like a happy record. It's a joyful record. And I think the idea of joy is that it sort of leaps out of an understanding of the world, of the kind of suffering, shall we say, of things, and it's the difference between that and a kind of happy record. I don't think it's a happy record at all. It has a sort of, it's a complex record that just keeps bursting into life and then sort of retreating and bursting again. And you know, there's a song called Frogs on it, which I really love this song, and it has these lines in it. A couple are walking through the rain, and it talks about the frogs in the gutters leaping to God and leaping to love, and amazed by pain and amazed by joy or something like that, and then landing back in the gutter again. And it was that little leap of the frog, the ecstatic leap of the frog, that seems to sum up the feel of the whole record to me. It's a sort of beautiful spiritual lift to the thing that kind of leaps and retracts.
It's my great privilege, oh babe, to walk you home in the Sunday rain. Sunday rain.
I'm speaking with Nick Cave on World Cafe. His new album with the Bad Seeds is called Wild God. There's a song near the beginning of the album called Joy. And you receive a visitor in the form of a ghost in giant sneakers, a flaming boy who says that it's time for joy.
Sat on a narrow bed, this flaming boy. Who sat on a narrow bed, this flaming boy said, we've all had too much sorrow, now is the time for joy.
I should say for people listening that I know that you lost your son, Arthur, a few years ago, and that was something that you've talked about a lot in grieving, especially through the albums Ghostine and Skeleton Tree, when you've been talking about those. And I was wondering, has experiencing such a devastating loss made those moments of joy feel more profound?
Yeah, I think... that word, once again, going back to that word joy, it comes into play as a way of being, as a form of experience that I think that sort of comes after understanding our vulnerable nature, and it's an earned emotion coming out of an understanding of our precarious nature. Mm. Unlike happiness is a different thing altogether. I mean, I've been happy throughout my life in various ways, but it really took the devastation to understand and accept the possibility of a kind of joyful relationship with the world. Now, this is something that when the sort of trauma first happens is not something you're going to ever imagine to be the case, but it is true. Grief does pave the way for great, so it paves the way for a kind of, for meaning, you know, there's a sort of expansion of the heart that allows, these moments of joy to become a kind of part of your life.
Yeah. It's soul. The word soul enriching feels not quite positive, but not quite negative. It's just sort of, it deepens an experience.
Well, you know, I think at this stage of my life, I mean, I'm looking for happiness, sure, and pursue happiness and do things that make me happy. But I'm more concerned with meaning and having a life that feels enriched, soul enriched, did you say?
Yeah.
And meaningful. And I think that the devastation that we're talking about or the grief or the kind of shattering of yourself is the first step on some level towards meaning. Mm. I think it's the first step to becoming a fully realized human being. You know, I mean, I don't want to look. I'm old. I'm like 66 or something like that, and it never sounds. It's never a good look for old people to start talking about how young people are, but there is a kind of. I think the beauty of young people is, I mean, this is not all young people, and some young people have experienced terrible things, but in general, young people don't know. They don't know what life really has in store for them. And so there's a kind of attachment to other things. There's a kind of search for meaning in other things, I think. And it takes that sort of tearing away of yourself or tearing down of yourself to realize the actual, to become a fully formed human being. Mm. I think young people essentially are only half formed.
Yeah.
Young people are probably not going to like me saying that. But in a way, they don't know. You know, they don't know the full potential of the world to what the world can actually give to them. I don't think they in a way understand the actual beauty of the world. And you learn, in my case, and I think for many people, you learn how extraordinarily beautiful the world actually is after the sort of the traumatic event.
Yeah, I mean, I am in my 30s, Nick, and I'm very, very fortunate. I've never experienced a big loss yet. And I am afraid of it. I'm very afraid of it because I haven't gone through that and I don't know what it will be like. And it scares me.
Well, you know, I mean, it is terrifying and life is terrifying in those ways. But I've found personally that it's a necessary, without being, you know, sort of some kind of doom monger, this is going to happen to you. It will happen to you. I mean, unless you're a hermit or everyone hates you or you hate everybody or something like that, eventually.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
You're going to lose people.
Of course.
And this is, you know, and you'll be confronted with the reality of the world. I feel terrible, like, talking to you in this way, actually. But it's the beginning of a journey towards a very rich, potentially very rich existence, and something that people fresh in their grief don't understand. But anyway, it's coming for you.
It makes me feel better.
It's going to be all right in the end.
Thank you.
I'm speaking with Nick Cave. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Nick will explain why he cannot divulge the real-life event that inspired one of the songs on his album, Wild God. That's in a moment on World Cafe.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
Welcome back to an encore World Cafe. My name is Raina Duras, and today you're hearing my 2024 session with Nick Cave, where we discuss his latest studio album with his band, The Bad Seeds, called Wild God.
The song Conversion on Wild God, you've said, is a central song on the record, and that there's a real-life event within it. Is there anything you could tell us about Conversion? Because I'd like to play the song.
You mean
what
happened?
Yeah.
Well, it was Conversion is something that I observed happen to my wife, right? And it was an extraordinarily beautiful thing. And I said, that's really beautiful. And she said, how about you don't write a song about it? How about you don't write a Red Hand file about it, right? Because living with me, it is like living with a kind of vampire that's sort of sucking everything out of everybody to create these songs. And there's a sort of quiet tension between me and my wife, who's extremely, extremely private person, and me, who's a public figure who just talks about anything. And she did sort of ask me, maybe that's just between us.
That's a perfect answer. Let's listen to Conversion. This is Nick Cave on World Cafe.
There was a little place in a pretty room where we mostly did not go. And next to the place in a field of trees, where stones stacked on stones for 10 centuries. Time in the field in the middle of the night, then old God shambled beneath the sodium light. The whole town gathered at the fence with looks on their faces worse than grief itself. The street with long dark hair knelt among the stones in the mystical flare. And the old God drew her into him like a flame. I've never seen you so beautiful as that again.
Touch my spirit.
From his new album, Wild God, you just heard Nick Cave with Conversion. I'm Raina Duris. It's World Cafe. Nick Cave is my guest today. Conversion on this album does kind of remind me of something that would be on Abattoir Blues in a way. There's the instrumentation, there's the build-up, there's the voice, the vocals, the backing vocals. I mean, you have many songs with that kind of build-up and that rising action and that catharsis. And when you hear those songs live, it's a pretty amazing experience. I've been to a few of your shows.
Oh, really? Have you?
Yeah. I wouldn't consider myself, you know, a religious person, but I'm absolutely not the first person to say that your shows feel like they can be a religious experience from the audience's point of view. People are reaching out to...
I don't understand how you can say that and not say that you're a religious person.
I guess that's a good point.
You know, I mean... What is the problem with saying you're a religious person?
Yeah, I guess I've never considered myself religious because it didn't fall into a religion. But it's, I would say...
I mean, if you're claiming you're having a religious experience, then surely you're a religious...
Well, I guess, then I wonder what is the difference between...
You can't have a religious experience and not be a religious person.
Religious, transcendent, spiritual, do those...
They're not all the same to me. They're not the same to me. I mean, spirit. I call my music religious music.
Yeah.
Because for me, religion is spirituality that sort of requires something of us. It's not just this vague thing, you know, this, I'm a spiritual person, you're a spiritual person, we've just had a spiritual experience, this glass of water is a spiritual thing, you know. This to me, I don't understand this sort of, I don't understand this idea at all. And to have, I think, a religious experience is to change from one thing into something else. Mm. And I think that that's what music... that's really what music has the potential to do, is to take a bunch of ordinary sort of broken people and bring them together, and music kind of enters them and changes them for a period of time into some other thing that is an improvement from the way that they were.
Yeah.
It's a very beautiful thing, and this to me is a religion. This is religion.
Then perhaps I am a religious person.
You are a religious person. You should come to church with me one day.
Maybe I will. But I know how it feels in the audience.
You know, just to go to the church. The church thing for me, church. The reason I go to that is it is a way of kind of taking these feelings that I have into a kind of a place that has its structure. It's not like I have certain sorrows we've been talking about, which I think we all have in one way or another, and certain feelings of loss. And religion sort of is a, or church is a place you can take, it's expressly designed for those feelings, where you can take those feelings and they're kind of, it's a, you're able to feel them safely. It's a place to go with these feelings. Whereas actually the secular world doesn't really have places for, you're on your own with this stuff.
Yeah.
Church allows you, is some way of, it wraps its arms around these feelings, you know. I mean, church has a whole lot of problems, obviously, right, which puts a lot of people off. And religion has a lot to answer for sure. I understand that. But there's a lot of beauty in it too.
How does it feel for you when it's sort of switched around, when you're not sitting in the pew at church, but you are on the stage as sort of the preacher figure to the audience who feels like they are going to church in a way.
Look, I don't try and come across as a preacher figure, but I do come across as someone, or I hope that is involved in a kind of an interplay of mutual uplift or something like that.
How are you so sure-footed? How do you not lose your balance when you're walking on top of the seats like that?
How do I do that? years of practice. It's actually rather easy to walk on people's heads. You should try it.
My guest this hour is Nick Cave. When our conversation continues, Nick talks about the way he writes about death and how it's evolved and changed since the beginning of his career. That's coming up after the break here on World Cafe. My name is Raina Duras, and today on an Encore World Cafe, you're hearing my interview with Nick Cave of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. It was recorded last year around the release of their latest studio album, Wild God.
You have a song on the album about a former member of the Bad Seeds, Anita Lane, who's also your former girlfriend. Anita passed away in 2021, and we hear her voice at the end of the song, oh, wow, how wonderful she is. Could you tell us about that recording that we hear?
The little piece of audio?
Yeah.
Yeah, some friends or some filmmakers wanted to do a kind of documentary about the Bad Seeds. They wanted to film each of the Bad Seeds. There's a lot of Bad Seeds over the years, and talk to them. And Anita was an original member of the Bad Seeds. And by the time they wanted to do that with her, she'd basically become a recluse. Over the years, she just became more isolated, and I still had a relationship with her and would see her and talk to her on the phone, and she wouldn't be filmed, and so the people rang me and said, "Look, is there any way you can convince her to be filmed?" And I said, "No, she won't be filmed," and I called her up and was talking to her about it and just recorded a little bit of her speaking to me that she didn't know I was recording. I did tell her afterwards, actually. And then a couple of years later, she died to absolute shock to everybody. Everyone loved Anita so much. And she was so important to us when we were all just finding our feet. You know, there was in Melbourne back in the late 70s, 80s, there was a genuine, punk movement in the same way as there was in New York and London and so on, and all these sort of dark male figures emerged, I would say, but one person who sort of rose out of that movement was Anita Lane, and she was just this beautiful, bright, laughing, sort of flame-like character who all these sort of, dour, drug-addicted men sort of circled around. Anyway, so I had this little piece of audio and I recorded the song, and I remembered that I had this, and I found it, and I gave it to my engineer and said, "Look, can you sort of stick this on the end of the song?" And went home and didn't listen to it, and in the morning came back into the studio and he put it on, and it was incredibly deeply moving, I love that song very much.
The clip itself is beautiful, and then it's kind of like what you were saying earlier, where the instrumentation underneath of the Bad Seeds do just infuses it with even more meaning as you're listening to it. Here's Oh Wow, Oh Wow, How Wonderful She Is from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds on World Cafe.
She rises in advance of her panties. I can confirm that God actually exists. She turns and smiles, but never, ever scantily.
You just heard Oh Wow, Oh Wow, How Wonderful She Is from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds from their new album, Wild God. I'm Raina Duris. They're talking about Anita. She co-wrote From Her to Eternity.
That's right, yeah.
In that song, there are many songs, I think, in your catalog that kind of romanticize loss or desire or this yearning. And you know, it makes me think about how so many of the songs that you wrote as a younger man were about violence and about death and things like that. And now you still write songs that are about death, but from a very different perspective.
Yeah.
After writing songs about that for such a long time, when you're faced with it, are you at all prepared?
No. I mean, you know, I think that the songs that I was... They're not helpful. You're not like practiced at it or something like that. No, you're just not. I mean, I had an interest in that stuff. I had almost an academic interest in these things because I was really interested in songwriting and I was really interested in what sort of shocking, outrageous, confronting, offensive lyrics could do within a song, and the sort of the feelings that, that you know, the way that they could make people feel, and you know, I was very much involved in art as something that caused offense to some degree, or challenged people, or sort of blew away people's complacency. This, to my generation, was seen as a kind of duty on some level to make this kind of music, music that was confronting. And so these darker matters found their way into songs as much for that reason as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying is that in a way it was a kind of youthful indulgence. And once again, going back to that, I had no idea actually about what I was writing about until I sort of experienced these things, you know.
Because the dead are very present on this album. There are gods, there are dead.
Yeah.
But they seem to... Like you said, it's joyful, it's not happy, but they seem to be kind of having a good time sometimes on it.
That's right. It's a uplifting record of dead people having a good time.
is there power in doing that, in writing about the dead and letting them be alongside you in that way?
Yeah, I didn't have any... idea of what I was doing. I don't have any control over the songs that I write particularly. I certainly don't have any overarching idea of what the record's going to be like. When I listened to it back, after it had been mastered, I waited a couple of weeks and then put it on and listened to it. And I just listened to it with a big smile on my face. It was like looking in the mirror and seeing... basically happy person that was still preoccupied with the same things, but I like what you said. I mean, I haven't really seen it in that way, but I like what you said, that it is full of the dead and those who have passed. But yeah, it's in no way a sorrowful thing.
Yeah.
They are animated and alive in some kind of way.
As we get closer to the end of this interview, here's a question that may be impossible to answer, but I'll ask you anyway.
Awesome.
How do you imagine your next life? How do you imagine it? When we talk about the dead and what comes next and feeling connected to
things. You mean,
how do I imagine
what happens after I die? Look, I have no idea and I have no authority to speak on such matters. And I have softly spoken, I would say, intuitions about these sorts of things that I don't keep, that don't really concern me. too much. It's not, I mean, I would call myself a religious person, but I'm not a religious person because I think that, you know, I'm going to live forever or go to heaven or something like that. I'm much more concerned with the condition of my present life and leading that in a way that has meaning, you know. So I'm not sure what to tell you about that. Well, what do you think's going to happen?
I don't know. That's why it's an impossible question to answer. But I think that tells me a lot when you say that what you're more interested in is this life. And that comes through on the album. I'm going to end...
You know, just on that point, you know, when I die, I want to sort of die, I would say, into life rather than sort of staring into death, but looking into, sort of falling backwards into death, if you understand what I mean, and looking at the things that I love in this life. You know, I this life's amazing. Mm. And the world that we live in is, you know, it's a beautiful thing, and human beings are a beautiful. When I die, I'm not sort of hoping, you know, for a better world. I think the world that we've got is extraordinary, personally. A controversial statement, I know.
But a lovely one. Mm. The album ends with the lines, "Peace and good tidings. He will bring good tidings to all things," which I kind of think goes very nicely with what you just said.
There you go.
Here is "As the Waters Cover the Sea," Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds on World Cafe. "The Waters Cover the Sea" from Wild God, the 2024 album from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. That was an encore session that originally aired last year. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds recently released a new live record documenting the recent Wild God tour called Live God. That's out now. Thank you again to Nick Cave, and thank you to World Cafe senior producer Kimberly Junod for her work on that session. Also, thank you to our affiliates across the country who bring you this show. We produce this show at WXPN at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm Raina Duris. Thanks for listening to World Cafe from NPR.
World Cafe is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org.